Greetings, user defenders. In October of last year, I was super excited to be invited back to an event apart to record a live podcast. And on the stage with me were some amazing guests. I had Mina Markham, I had Derek Featherstone, and Farai Madzima. And we discussed accessibility, inclusive design, design ethics, and landing a job in UX. A lot of good stuff. Somehow we managed to tackle all of this and a couple of audience questions in just under an hour. I want to thank Jeffrey Zeldman and Eric Meyer for having me back and their awesome crew. They have some amazing folks behind the scenes putting on, making this possible, these events. So some really great people involved with this conference. And I highly recommend attending if you have a chance. So lastly, for transcripts and photos and stuff, please visit the show notes page at userdefenders.com/071. And now with that, please enjoy this very special live podcast and important conversation from an event apart Denver.
We are going to be talking about some really important stuff in that as it concerns our design community, like inclusive design, accessibility, landing a job in UX. I know that that's a real big design problem as well that a lot of folks are kind of going through. And so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to my guests here to let them introduce themselves. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us your design superpower?
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Mina Markham. I am a staff engineer at Slack. I say this a lot, but I don't work on the Slack product you all know and love. I actually work on the Slack marketing website. So I do more, mostly my job is to explain what Slack is to people who don't know what Slack is. My design superpower is I act as a sort of bridge or translator between the engineering framework, frame of mind, and the designer frame of mind. I have a background in design and switched to engineering, so I can think like both and can talk to both very easily.
It's a great superpower. Farai?
Awesome. My name is Farai Madzima. I'm a UX manager at Shopify in Ottawa. And I guess I would say my superpower, my design superpower, is actually around building design teams and making sure that they are cross-culturally aware, because the teams that we're building these days are built from people who are coming from all over the world. And we assume that if we get smart people in a room together, they're going to work amazingly, but typically that doesn't happen. And so, yeah, that's my jam.
Awesome. And Derek?
I'm Derek Featherstone. I'm the Chief Experience Officer at Level Access. We're an accessibility consulting and software platform agency company. I think my design superpower is including and remembering the people that are often forgotten.
Mm. Wow. That's awesome. So I realized I forgot to tell you how to join the list. Userdefenders.com/join will get you right to the sign up. That's bad UX. I apologize. I think we need to start with actually what may be the most important question I'm going to ask tonight. And that is, Mina, when is Beyonce going to hire you to make her website accessible?
For real. For
Come
real.
On, right?
You know, I've been trying. I've tried, y'all, for like for almost a year at this point. There's a petition. I'll talk about it tomorrow on my talk, so come and see. But yeah, I don't know. I would love the job. It's a dream job, and I actually could do the job. So please me, if you're listening, just hire me. I could make your life so much easier.
Yes, yeah, sign the petition. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So, I'm curious. Let's jump into accessibility, because this is a really important issue in our field, obviously, and there's been a lot of strides made. But I'm wondering, are you all happy with the strides made toward accessibility as becoming more of a standard this year? Dominoes.
So, I think there has been good strides made in getting like people more aware of the need for sites to be accessible, which is the first step. I still think there's enough friction that we haven't made enough strides in making the web a completely inclusive and accessible place. Seeing, you know, the dominoes of the worlds, and even though I love her, Beyonce.com is still not accessible. Like, there's just so many major sites that still don't think about people who can't see the screen or can't use a mouse, and they just don't see these edge cases versus, like, just actual use cases, where I don't think we've made enough strides where we don't think of these as, like, fringe cases, more like this is just something that is a part of your job and something that you need to do.
So there's been a lot of strides, definitely positive movement, but the biggest issue that I still see that just doesn't seem to go away is, even with all the things that are happening in the community and with lawsuits and things like that, and again, the legal part of accessibility is, like, my least favorite part of it. It's the thing that I dislike probably the most. But it unfortunately seems to be kind of necessary. I think the biggest thing that still bothers me, or I see that's holding us back, is that people think that it is hard to do, or it's going to take a whole lot of time, a whole lot of money. And the reason that it ends up doing that is not because it's hard in and of its own right. It's because we're talking about doing this stuff at scale. And it's because we're talking about trying to change people's minds about something that they've already made their minds up about. And so many people just still feel like, as you know, something where maybe it hasn't touched them, where disability hasn't touched them in their lives, they're thinking that it's very much an other thing and it has nothing to do with them. And, oh, do we really have to do this? Like, what percentage of people are we talking about? And they don't realize that, like, it's everybody. It's 50% of us. By the time we get to 70-ish years old, it's 50% of us. Wow. And people kind of just haven't really woken up to the fact that's a thing, and we should really just be a lot more respectful and understanding of everybody that we're designing for, and not just people that we think are this fictionalized view of who we should be designing for. So lots of strides, but still kind of sad. I feel like I'm totally bringing this down. Like, I want to
keep it real.
Yeah, it's awesome. But there's a lot of things that just aren't, it's tough to convince people still. And it's sad that we need to convince people. Probably nobody that's in this room, but it's people in the other rooms that they just need to be convinced still for whatever reason. They don't believe it. They don't believe it's valuable. So I could talk about that for a long time, but I'm already getting sad myself, so I'm going to stop talking.
It's happy hour, Derek.
It was happy
hour. It was.
So currently I'm working in Canada, but I was actually originally born in Zimbabwe, and I worked in South Africa between 2011 and 2017. And what's interesting there is, when you say strides and y'all have recognized strides, where I was working, there's been none of that. Right? Because folks are still, the people who buy the skills of web designers and web developers are still just grappling with the idea of having a website, then having one that kind of works well. The idea of accessibility, the ideas around performance, and even, folks just hiring like a user experience designer or an information architect to make sure that this thing works right. Those are concerns that at this moment are way, way down the list. And the communities of designers and developers are growing, and they're building, and they're trying to have these conversations among themselves, and then trying to get those conversations into business and all of those things. But the strides that y'all are seeing here in North America, like on that continent, there's even less that's happening. So, wow. Yeah.
Why do you think that is, Brian?
This trade, what we do here, is young there, right? And so you are finding people who are getting into web development for the first time now. You've got people, the folks who run an event apart have been building sites for days. Whereas on the other side, you're finding people who are only just getting to grips with, okay, this is what we can do. This is what's possible. right? And then getting those skills and finding that, well, there are not enough experienced people who can teach us the right stuff, the standards. Now, all the stuff is available on the web, right? And you could learn that, but the people buying the services and people who are saying, please build a thing for me, they're not gonna put that at the front of their list. Okay. All they want is to say, I've got a URL, I can point a browser at it and something will pop up that looks like my logo. And that can handle these transactions or whatever it is. And that's satisfactory for a large amount of people. I think there's a lot that still needs to be learned in the people who are buying the services, as well as the people who are doing the building around, you know, how do you make something that is great and performant and looks awesome and delivers on all the needs of the business and the users? Those are questions that we're still kind of grappling with. And it's not to say everybody, there are some great examples coming out, but that is not the norm. And I wouldn't say that conversations around accessibility or any of those things are, you know, rife in any shape or form.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And Derek, you say that accessible design is better design. And I think it's just better design for everybody. And I really like that. I think that's something that is kind of really helping to shape what we do, thinking about design that way. And you're right. I mean, we're all just temporarily abled, right? I mean, like, I had to get glasses a couple years ago. My optometrist said I beat the odds by 1 year, I guess. Yeah, 42 was like, 42 or 41 or something is the normal age for most people needing eye care, eyeglasses. So I'm kind of, my empathy levels are increasing all the time, and I injured myself a couple years ago. I slipped on the ice out here and tore my tendon and tore my cartilage, and then all of a sudden I'm in a chair for 6 months, practically, you know, like just with crutches, and I gained great levels of empathy. But I feel like it's unfortunate that sometimes it takes us to actually go through something before we actually take it more seriously. Does it seem that way?
Yeah, I mean, there's one of the biggest challenges is like people don't understand, you know, how valuable it can be. You know, we do talk about that when we build something and design something and make it better for somebody with a disability or take that into account in the design right from the get-go, that it ends up, you know, and I can point to lots of cases where it almost every single time it makes it just a better design. I think I did a talk at an event apart in 2015, I think, called Extreme Design, and it was literally case after case after case where every single thing that we did to make an example better from an accessibility perspective, it ended up being better for people without disabilities as well. And so people, you know, kind of don't understand that accessibility is a great tool for innovation, that it's a thing that is for all of us, and that it can actually make some really incredible, designs happen. It's a design tool in and of its own right. And inclusive design kind of takes us that way. When we work with clients and they are embracing inclusive design, they come up with new solutions that they never would have thought of if they had not engaged people with disabilities in the research process and in the testing process. And they sometimes come up with, you know, new features for a product. Sometimes they come up with entirely new products that spin off of the original idea simply because they engaged people that were, you know, maybe they thought were like different than them. So there's tremendous value in doing it, but I just don't think enough people have any experience with it, either, you know, personally at touching them in their lives, but they also haven't been through a process that incorporates accessibility and inclusion into it. So they don't necessarily know what it's like. And so what they're basing their feelings like, oh, this is going to be horrible, or this is going to reduce my creativity or take away my creativity, is all based on this fictionalized vision of what they think it is, not on an experience that they've actually had. So they're using false data in the place of having actually gone through it. And so that, I think, just taints their view of what it's going to be like. And so they maybe are less willing to explore it in the first place. But I know some of the most, some of the most satisfying, professionally satisfying things that I've participated in have been things where we have been working really closely with people with disabilities to solve problems that ended up making things just phenomenally better for everybody else. And it's one of the most incredible feelings when you can contribute to making the world better like that. So I don't even know. Did that even answer your question?
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know if it... Either way, I'm happy with that answer.
I really like the point that you raised around thinking about accessibility, inclusive design, and using that as a framing for innovation, and coming up with new, better ideas for everybody, as opposed to just ideas that will serve this what people could think of as a small community. And I don't think enough people are thinking about it that way or working it that way. So that's a cool idea.
I think almost nobody thinks about it that way, right? And I think that's partly just because people haven't been, like I said, people haven't experienced it or gone through it. You know, design sprints, that's like a thing. Everybody's like, oh, design sprints. I want to do like an inclusive design sprint with teams for a week, and just like, it would be incredible, I think, what people would learn in that. I think I just created something. But like, we should be doing that, right? Like, to give people a chance to experience it so they learn about things in a different way than just thinking it's something different. I know a lot of people, they kind of get, you know, they think it's going to take so much longer. And the reality is it's only taking longer because they're learning it, right? If everybody was doing something in React and they suddenly said, okay, we're going to switch everything from React to Angular, or vice versa, or whatever it was, that's going to take time because they have to learn the new ways of, you know, the new ways of doing things, and accessibility is no different. So it's not that it takes longer because it's accessibility, it takes longer because they're learning, right? And they just haven't got the experience to back it up. So, yeah.
So I want to ask this question in kind of two parts. What are the major obstacles to accessibility you still see needing to be addressed to continue down this road? And for those of us just getting our feet wet into accessibility, what are some quick win things that we can try to better empathize with disabled folks that we may not currently be considering in our work?
So touching on the small wins you can do to empathize. One very easy thing you can do is unplug your mouse for a day and just use the keyboard to navigate and see how easy it is or how difficult it could be to get around and actually do things, interact on the applications and sites that you build. And it may surprise you, like maybe you built everything using semantic HTML and it's almost there at the beginning, but you're more than likely you're gonna find some keyboard traps or you're gonna not know where you're focusing on to begin with because the focus state's been removed. So just that's one very simple thing you can do to kind of build that empathy muscle to see how can someone not using a mouse, can they navigate and do simple interactions on this site that I've made? If not, then that's your first step.
That's really good.
Number one best way, even though, and this is a simple way to get started, even though it might seem like this is a big step, go and talk with somebody that has a disability. Go sit with them, watch how they do their work, you know, obviously get permission and that sort of thing. But that's real. Like that, you learn stuff that you just never thought you would learn. I see a lot of stuff going on where people are, you know, they'll write a Medium post about it. They're like, I used a screen reader for a day and look how woke I am. You know, like stuff like that. And it's like, go and sit with somebody that actually uses a screen reader and talk to them. Like, just talk to them. Talk to them. Like, you don't have to go and start using a screen reader yourself. I mean, you can, cool, but your experience is not going to be what the experience of somebody that actually relies on that screen reader is. And I would bet that many people are going to be, you know, one of the things that people always think of is like, oh my gosh, people with disabilities have it so bad because I used a screen reader for 2 hours and I sucked because it was so fast. I couldn't understand it. I'm like, you have no idea. Like people that actually use a screen reader are listening to it 5 times as fast as you are, and they can get through a heck of a lot more than you can. So don't be, you know, what we talk about empathy and what there's a lot of things that we do or try to do that end up generating sympathy rather than empathy. Empathy is like, go and sit with them and learn about their lived experience, not like some other thing. Although I love, like, the unplug your mouse for a day, that is fantastic. Like, that's absolutely a great way to go because that teaches you a lot of stuff. But if I can implore you to do one thing, is find somebody with a disability next month, this month. Well, it's almost November, right? So in November, go find one person that has a disability and go learn a bunch of stuff from them, and then go find another person in December and a different person in January, a different person. Do it one person every month for the next year, and you will transform you. That's it.
Love it. That's awesome. So this next one's kind of a big one. And I'm going to kind of set it up, but hopefully not bias it too much. A couple years ago, my daughter, I think she was probably like 1.5 or so, really young still. My wife was away out of town visiting her mom, and my daughter was having some real breathing challenges, and I kind of laid down next to her, and because I was really concerned, it was getting really bad. And then I finally got to the place where I was like, okay, I gotta get her to the hospital because it was that bad. The thing is that I wasn't really prepared. I didn't know which hospital to take her to exactly. That was kind of on me. But when I did figure out the hospital, I went to the website, and then here I am just like scrambling, panicking, trying to find a phone number and even an address for the hospital, and I couldn't find it on the website and in a visible location, and that was a bit of a challenge. And then there's the James Lang, VW emissions engineer. You all familiar with that story? He was coding the emissions test to favor the VW vehicles during the test, but then after the test was complete, he had some sort of trigger that said, okay, now you can go back to, you know, polluting the environment or whatever. So he actually got locked up for that. He's in prison, I think, for 4 years. And so I guess the code you write can and will be used against you in a court of law. And so that was a really interesting example. And then, of course, there's a lot of other things. You know, Facebook has done a lot of things, unfortunately. And I know Eric has been, you know, has really felt a lot from that in not a positive way. And, you know, Uber's doing tracking stuff. There's a lot of things happening that aren't ethical in our field, sadly, and all for the sake of engagement or, you know, more numbers or more growth or whatever it might be. So I guess here's the setup. That was the setup. And I'm just wondering, you know, medical doctors have to go to school for 8+ years and take a Hippocratic oath to ensure their treatment of humans is ethical. Architects sometimes spend over 12 years on their education and certifications to design structures humans will dwell in. Are you all sick of the should designers thing? Are everybody sick of that? Should designers go, should design? Well, I got a new one for you. Should designers have to agree to a code of ethics and or become certified to design for other human beings? Why or why not?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Because that's the right thing to do.
All right.
I'll add a little more to that. Sorry, that was very.
Yeah, drop that mic, buddy.
No, but so I say this coming from Ontario, Canada. I live in Ottawa, and one of the things that we have a long history of in Ontario is we have a registered graphic designer society, and that actually requires people to go through certain parts of training as part of their schooling. And they get certification and they get that and they're part of this registry. We do the same thing for teachers. We do the same thing for, you know, for lots of other professions. I would be in favor because that's one of the ways that we can actually, you know, help make sure that secondary school and post-secondary school curricula have some of these topics woven into them, because there's lots of teachers that would, you know, unless it's part of the curriculum and somebody says they have to teach it, they wouldn't necessarily think to include it. So if that pathway, and I haven't even considered all the knock-on implications of this, like I'm saying yes, but I don't know what that does to the industry or all the other things that go with it. But from a pure idealistic perspective, I think that would certainly put us in a better position than we're in now. Maybe, I don't know. But that's my thinking anyway.
I had not thought about that. I think I would feel bad for saying no. I don't know if I would feel bad for saying no. So, but But I, you know, like, I mean, that would be probably based on, like, as you say, the impact of, you know, what does that mean when we already can't get people into the industry, and then, you know, we, is this a new barrier, you know, on all those different things. But the other side of it, I think, is along with that is a recognition that the impact of the products that we are working on has got gravitas and has long-lasting impacts that are non-trivial. And as an industry, we do need to recognize that. It may not be that you need, maybe for when you're working on certain products, you need this or something like that. But I think it is long past time that we recognize in some sort of way that what we are doing has got non-trivial impact, that is on a global scale, and that, you know, like Spider-Man, you know, Stan Lee, like, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And, you know, we need to have better conversations around that, and we need to be able to help you hold each other to account for some of those choices, I think, in a much better way than nothing right now.
I'm kind of a combination of both people, actually. Idealistically, yes, I think we should definitely do it, because we've kind of proven that without that kind of governing sort of entity or body or whatever you want to call it, we're not good at policing ourselves. So it would be, just from a sure, like, empathetic, like, human point of view, yeah, we should probably all do this, because otherwise we're probably not going to do it on our own volition. On the other hand, I do recognize that adding another barrier to entry to this industry for some people who already have a hard time getting into it could be a problem. So idealistically, yes, we definitely should. Practically, I don't know how it would work, but I would love to be able to figure that out.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So those very thought-provoking responses on that one. And I know that one's a heavy one. You know, that's kind of like, there's a lot of gravitas. I like that word, Farai. There's a lot of gravitas to that question. And it's, I guess it's kind of one of those things that there's really maybe no right or wrong answer yet to that. And maybe there won't be. But it's interesting to see that conversation kind of happening a little more, especially just in light of some of the ethical things or unethical things that are happening or that have happened as well. So that'll be interesting to kind of watch unfold. Now, we know that big problems are best solved with a diversity of perspectives. However, building diverse teams is proving to be a difficult design problem that needs solving. And I'm wondering, for the folks listening who may be hiring and building design teams, what's your best advice and strategies for them to get better at this, at building diverse teams? Is this worse?
So I think maybe the first thing, a piece of advice I would say, is stop looking in the same places for your hires and your recruits. People tend to hire people they know and like-minded people. So Me working in Silicon Valley, it's a lot of the same schools are going to recruit graduates. And I would just say, stop looking in the same places and go look somewhere else. You're not going to find a different type of engineer, a different type of designer, if you're looking at the same place you hired the ones you already have. So find another place. I don't believe there's a pipeline issue. I don't believe that at all. You're not looking in the right places. So just go find where these people are and stop looking at the Stanfords of the world, is pretty much what I want to say.
I'd echo that. I think definitely, like, looking in the same places and also looking in the same way. Coming from South Africa, you know, I see, you know, from where I was, you know, I moved to Shopify 2 years ago. I would look at job ads that are across the ocean and I'd be like, that could never be for me. That doesn't speak to who I am and where I'm at. Because the challenges that, and when I say challenges, I mean the mental barriers and some of those other things that somebody who is on that side of the world is facing when they're thinking about moving over here are very different to what somebody who is in, you know, Arizona is thinking about when they see a job ad for something in New York, right, at Facebook. And I think being able to understand what are the things that the people who are in the places that you aren't looking as well, what message do you need to send to them to tell them about what is it like for you to take this job, right? So for example, a simple thing, relocation, right? Relocation is huge, right? And sometimes a job ad would just say, relo is possible. But if you've worked in North America and you see relo as possible, you've got an understanding of what that means. if you're posting that same job ad in a market that has no understanding of what that means, then you need to be much more clear about what are we talking about here. What we're saying is we're going to bring you and your family, we're going to pack up your house, and we're going to bring you to this side of the world, and we're going to get you a visa, right? Mm. That is an entirely different proposition from just one line that says, yes, we do relocate. So I think, yes, look in places that you aren't traditionally looking, but understand what the barriers are that are stopping people from applying.
Okay. Sorry, I had a quick addendum to the relocation part of it. Also, pay for relocation up front. I've seen many jobs who do relocation on a reimbursement basis, which is a huge barrier for people who don't have a flux of cash to do that on their own. Like, so offer relocation, yes, but also just pay for it and don't rely on the person you're hiring to take care of it and submit all the paperwork later.
Yeah, that is just a non-stop. It's not going to happen. Right, because to pack up my house and bring it from South Africa to Canada is going to cost $12,500. Right, if I'm earning a salary that is like I don't know, $1,500 a month, I'm never going to be able to raise that money. Like I'm paying so that I can work for you. Hmm. Does that make sense? No. It's like that's not going to be a jam. I didn't know that.
Mm. Yeah, that doesn't sound like a good arrangement.
So just one last quick thing on diversity, which you know. I'm the white dude talking about diversity.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
So one of the things that I think about, because we see this in our industry a lot when we talk about accessibility and what that means, we usually think of, and I'm not saying we, I'm saying like the industry, we usually get excited and happy if we have made something that works well with a screen reader. Right. And so my response to that often is like, cool, but that's like, you know, 0.01% of what diversity and accessibility actually means. It's not that it's not important, it's just we have to think broader than that. So we have to diversify diversity. And when we see a lot of initiatives these days where there's companies have diversity, equality, and inclusion initiatives and things that they're doing. And what they usually mean is we're going to hire people of a diverse racial profile or gender identity profile, but we almost never see them publicly talking about what they're doing for hiring people with disabilities and a variety of disabilities in the process. I say this as an older white dude, like not very good in terms of hiring diversity in terms of age. Like I'm at a point where I'm like, there's going to come a point in my career where I'm not far away from maybe being like not doing well in any job interview ever again because of how old I might be. And so that's, you know, when we're thinking about hiring diverse teams, I just want to, the only thing that I'm, you know, trying to contribute, I guess, is diversifying what we mean by diversity and not just thinking about the things that usually get brought up in some of that. So, you know, that socioeconomic profile, things that we just don't often think of, like, you know, I know one of the things that we did at our company before we got, you know, merged and acquired by another company. But one of the things that we tried to do, we actually looked and we were like, we don't have anybody on our team that is older than 45 or whatever it was. I don't remember what it was at the time, but we're like, we should actually actively start looking. If we find some equally qualified candidates and we've got the choice to bring in some of that other perspective from older, some people that might be older than what our current pool of you know, people that are working for us is, we should really be considering that. So that's the only thing I would throw out is to diversify what we mean by diversity when we're thinking about building diverse teams.
I'd also add to that, it's one thing to say you want to get people in the door. The other thing is, are you keeping them, right? So it may not be that people chat about the pipeline thing, but there's a leaky bucket thing, right? Where it's like, we're getting people in, but we can't keep them. Because we're saying, well, yeah, we hired them, so we checked the box. But the reality is that once you rock up and you're the first one, that's tough. And it's a tough journey to wait until there's 2, 3, 4, 5 of you, until you are represented in a way where you don't feel like you are a minority and that you have a voice and all those things. So the work is to get folks in, and then the inclusion work is to make sure that we understand what are the difficulties that someone faces when they're one of a kind, and how do we make sure that we can help them to navigate those things and give them the support that they need. Until, you know, we build up, you know, that crew, that squad. So those things go hand in hand. And it helps you when you've got, when you keep people, then other people will look and they go, oh, look, it's growing. There's something going on over there. And there's a gravity well that's happening over there, right? But on the other hand, if your bucket keeps leaking, that's also a signal, right? Where people go, yeah, I was there for a few months, but I didn't stay. You know, so those things go hand in hand. It's, you don't want to get people in, but you want to make sure that you keep them as well. And that is, if not even more difficult.
Yeah, one way to keep them is to promote them. I've seen so many people of color and women who just stagnate at a company because they can't get past whatever level they're at, because whatever the criteria for promotion is very skewed and biased towards a certain type of person. And that's what triggers leaky buckets. They're like, well, I can't progress here, so I have to go somewhere else. Like, that's actually how a lot of marginalized people advance their career, is by doing the job hopping, by getting that next level title at the next company they work for. So get them in the door and then keep them there by supporting them, and that includes promoting them.
Yeah. That's good. I am going to open it up for questions, so think about it. Some questions to ask this awesome panel. We have a few more here that I'd like to squeeze in, though. So let's talk about, like, landing a job in UX. And I mean, I guess there's a lot of different challenges in that, but one of the ones I keep seeing, especially on Twitter a lot, is the whole 3 to 5 years experience required for an entry-level job. Do y'all have thoughts on this? And doesn't that sound weird? But that's really kind of how a lot of people are being served in the industry, and it's kind of it's really odd. So I'm curious. Do you have any thoughts on this? And then how do we fix this?
I don't know how to fix it, but I do know that I have, like, as a person that used to hire people, I always wanted. This is probably one of my biggest, I don't regret a whole lot of things that I've done, but one, like, thing that actually sticks with me is that we did not do a good job of hiring people that were at an entry level or very junior and mentoring them as, like, the next wave of professionals in the community and in the industry. So we wanted to hire people that could hit the ground running. That was what we always, like, why we don't have time. We need to go faster. And it was, you know, as I look back, it's probably the one thing that I wish I could change. Like, we should have put ourselves as a company in a position where we would have had the luxury of having the time to be able to do that, so that we didn't always feel like we were so, you know, got to go faster, got to get this done, don't have time to mentor junior people. And I feel like as a company, we could have done that better, and that would have been much better, not just for us, but also for the industry. I'm talking specifically about kind of the accessibility industry, but I think it probably translates to a lot. So I don't know how to change that, other than to, you know, like, if we could have done that, I would have very much liked that we would have not always been in such a situation where we were so running, you know, very much agency life. We're running so tight to every deadline, to every little thing that needs to be done. If I could have, I would have put ourselves in that position where we would have been able to, you know, had that luxury of being able to do that. And maybe it's not a luxury, maybe it's more of a necessity, but that's the thing that probably sticks with me the most, that we couldn't do that for more people.
I'm thinking that and I'm just making this up as we go along, as an industry, we like to reap the fruit when it is ripe, but we are not interested in planting seeds. Mm. We're not interested in looking after saplings and seeing them grow. And that's a thing that we need to do. I think that, so I was at, I remember there was a show conference, and Koi Vin from Adobe was speaking, and he was talking about the cathedral and the bazaar. So this idea that, so in software, we talk about the idea, I'm going to get this wrong, but the idea of the cathedral is that the ideal piece of software is written in the one book, and the book is released every once in a while, and everybody gets kind of access to that, you know, and you do this thing, and there are the clergy or whoever it is who make that all of that happen. If you want to make a change in that, you're probably going to need to join the clergy. Whereas the market idea or the bazaar idea is that, you know, there is a market of ideas and it's open source and, you know, you can make a thing, you put it out there and somebody else might take a bit of that, they might work with that and do something different. This is what we see in engineering. Engineering is open. Engineering says, come by and join us. Here's how we work. You go to GitHub and you will see so many examples of how, you know, like literally you can go through every single commit of a piece of software to see how it was built. You can see every single comment and understand how people improved the thing that they made right up until the point that it was shipped. But when we look at designs, you can never see that, right? All you see is finished product. You know, in my mind, I'm looking at, if you think about looking at GitHub and going through like the commit and the commit history and all of those things, you're pretty much seeing a design review history. Like how this design, how this product evolved. But in the work that we do, we don't do that. So what the point Koi was making is that the design industry is very closed. We don't welcome people. We don't say everybody should design. Only the people who know how to design should design. Whereas the engineering community is like, build a thing. Here are all the tools. It's you know, it's cheap, it's free, and all of those things. And that means that more and more people can come to the party and they can actually get on with that. Whereas, you know, in design, I think we could do a better job of kind of inviting other people to come to the party. And, you know, internships are great things. Bring people in, make them meaningful, pay them to be an intern, you know, give them meaningful work. They're not here to work and, you know, at the coffee machine. You know, give them meaningful work that's actually going to grow them and give them an opportunity to, you know, be something and do something, you know, meaningful. I think, you know, in the design industry, we can do more of that. I think in engineering, they do way more of that than what I've seen in design anyway, across the board. I think there are a few large organizations that do it for designers, but it's not general across the board. You'll probably find more computer science people being able to get co-ops and internships than you would designers. And I think, yeah, so, and that is the growing the saplings. That's planting the seeds. You know, how much are designers being involved in what's happening at university and making sure that people know that this is a thing that you can do and having access and role models and all of those different things. I think, yeah, we got work to do there.
Yeah, like that. Jeffrey was on the show recently, and we were talking about web design and keeping the spirit alive. And I love what you said. You said we need to jam. We need to jam more. You know, as designers, have that jam session. And I really like that. That's an interesting point about the engineering community versus the design community. What can we learn from the engineering community to kind of invite people to that jam session a little more? I like that. So let's do one more, and then we'll open it up for questions to the audience. Let's see. So I like soft skills a lot. I'm biasing the question again, but I feel like the hard skills, like if we have a growth mindset, which hopefully we all do, we realize that we can learn anything we really truly want to learn and apply ourselves to learn. But I'm curious. In your experience, how important have you found soft skills to be when landing a job and also, or just in the job in general? And also, what are your best ways you found to grow in them?
There are no soft skills.
There are no soft skills?
No, sir. There might be a bunch of things that fit into that bracket as you describe it. It's all hard.
Right? Yes.
It's all hard.
Concur.
I'll tell you, in the last 2 years of my job since I moved to Shopify, the hardest thing has been, I have never needed to be as introspective for any aspect of my life as I've had to do for the move and for the job, to be effective and to be leading people really, really well. And that ish is hard. And I think when we call it soft, we are not characterizing it as, with the gravitas, I'll bring that word back, that it requires. It is just as, you know, the skills that we need to make our product better are just as important, just as difficult as the skills that we need to make our teams better and our companies better, right? And those are the things that some people would call soft skills, but yeah, there is nothing soft, and they are absolutely necessary. And we just, you know, to get to your question, we don't focus on them enough. And not enough people have got what it takes, and we excuse a lot of people who don't have that. Because we would say, well, you know, your craft skills are like off the charts, and so it's cool, you can come through and you can do whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but you need to not only have the responsibility of making our product better, but you need to be able to make our team better. And that means that everything that you're doing when you're not at your desk punching the keyboard, like, you need to have skills in that, and you need to be great at that as well.
Love it.
He kind of took my thunder there a little bit, but no, it's fine. I'll just build on top of that. I was going to say that I don't like the term soft skills because it's kind of inherently gendered, and it gendered towards these skills are more likely to be skills that a woman has, to be kind of blunt like that. And it tends to lead towards... Women do a lot of the glue work inside of a company, and what I mean by glue work is that they do a lot of the organizing and a lot of like the community building that is just as important but doesn't get recognized and doesn't get, that's not a line in the promo packet that gets you the next level. Like, it's important work that's invisible work, but no one really rewards it. So I don't like the term soft skills because it kind of implies that these skills are more things that like not true hardcore engineers do or need to learn how to do or whatever you want to call it. So. But as you said, they're just as important. And I think that they are skills that everyone should build up and learn to be more effective as engineers, as designers, as whatever your role may be. And to pick one that I think is a good one for everyone to have, I would say empathy is probably the biggest skill that is not very, I don't really know how to teach it. It's just something that I think that I don't know how to build those empathy muscle. Like, I don't know how someone builds up that muscle, but I think it makes everyone more effective at their job if they just are able to have like basic empathy for people who are outside of their lived experience.
Hmm. Love that.
So you asked about, you know, how do those skills, we'll call them something else, those hard skills.
Like hard, soft skills.
The hard people skills, whatever we want to call them, but you know, how does that have a role in getting a job, in keeping a job, and
yeah.
Like, they're almost everything to a certain extent, right? Like, if you can't negotiate and read people and understand people and communicate well with people and be part of a team and all of that, then you might as well, like, this sounds super harsh, I'm realizing as I'm saying it, but like, you might as well just go be your own company of one, right? Like to be part of a team, you have to have those skills. So they're critical. And I know lots of people that just don't have those skills, and they, you know, they couldn't maybe talk to clients, or, and I'm thinking like in my past too, like people that just don't have those skills, those people skills at all, and it ends up that they're not successful. So how do they play a role in getting a job and keeping a job? They're like, I don't know, they're probably part of everything. And I know, so this was another thing that I'm super proud of. When we used to hire people, we tried very hard to basically get people to do like a little bit of contract work with us first. And so we would have people going through an interview process because we wanted to see, what is it like to work with these people? The only way to figure that out is to work with those people. And so we would do like a 10 hour, even if you were like, if you got to that point where we were like considering hiring you, we did a 10 hour, $50 an hour, you know, because we didn't want it to be spec work, but we also didn't want it to be like super onerous, but also like not paying people like ridiculous hourly rates. So we would pay people $50 an hour for 10 hours to work on a thing with us so that we could get at least some idea of what it was like to work with people. And one of the things that we were always looking for was, can you communicate? Can you teach somebody else? And do you take feedback and learn, right, from the things that we do? And so those were the things that we tried to hire for all the time. And I say all the time, I don't mean all the time. Once we got through to a point where we realized that that's how we should be doing things, that's how we did it. So like, to me, it's, I don't know if more people hire like that or are thinking about hiring like that, but we picked it up from reading a book called Joy Inc. And where the entire premise of the book and the company was, what if we based this entire company around the concept of joy? Right. And therefore, It brings us great joy when we are working with people that we know we can work with. And when we're working with people that aren't, you know, that it, where it's not a good relationship, that's not joyous. And therefore, you know, how do we maximize joy in the company? And so we read that book, and that kind of changed our perspective on hiring. And it had a huge impact on us. And I think many of the people that we hired, if they didn't have some of those skills, then they wouldn't have been hired. And so I think it's just, I'll go with my first three words. It is critical.
Nice. I like the idea of that book. Maybe that's like an onboarding, like here's a book, check it out. This is kind of how we try to work together and how we try to, I love the joy aspect of it, because it is really joyful when you're working with great people and that you're really all striving to make things better for other people. Right. So I like that. Does anybody have any questions? We have a few more minutes. There's one in the back there.
Hello. My name is Leo Caldas, and I'm a visual designer at Capital One. You guys covered a lot of topics, and I kind of want to address just some of them. I think they're extremely important. Starting with, how do you teach empathy? This is just me sharing. I'm not telling you this is the way, but if I were to share with you, how would you go about that? I would say definitely going through therapy is one way you can find out more about yourself and understand how other people may or may not feel. And also this idea of vulnerability. So the work that Brené Brown is doing in terms of research and what that means to the human experience, there's a lot that you can gain from that, just diving deep into that whole thing. With the mention of the age, what do you do when you get older and you're a professional and, you know, are you still relevant? Are you still in the game? Like, what's that about? Something that came to mind was the idea of soft skills. So in this sense, I'm being a little bit of a contrarian, but I think, if anything, that's one thing that the age and the experience can bring to the table in terms of saying no and not having anxiety about problem solving and quick decision making, just let that play out. That's something that you have to gain and like learn about, and that's just not gonna come up right away. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention was this idea of meeting the customer where they're at. So a young person, you know, has different needs and specifics than someone that's been through this, that is older and has gotten a lot of experience. So how do you design for that? How do you prepare for that? And you really do have to dig in deep to kind of understand what that means for that particular individual at that age or that experience. I don't know if you can maybe comment on that.
What was your question exactly?
I guess the last one, so meeting people where they're at. So what does that mean if a customer is, let's say, a new, young person, or if they're older, more experienced, what are those differences, what are those nuances, and how does that apply to design, let's say?
So I'm not sure if this will address your question or not, but I know we do a lot of work with clients that are doing you know, they do summative research at the end, or evaluative research, to figure out, hey, did we do this thing right? But many of our clients are getting to the point, particularly within the accessibility space, where they're starting to do more foundational research and generative research, and including people, you know, diverse populations in that. That's how we connect, right? We need to not just do all of our research with, you know, 24 to 32 year old males, right? We have to embrace that diversity in the research that we're doing as well. And I you know, the lens that I usually put on that is people with different disabilities, but we could extend that very easily to people with different disabilities, people in different age groups, people with different, you know, different gender and gender identification, or gender identity, racial profile, you know, nationality, ethnicity, wherever you, where you know, where you come from. So that diversity, in my mind, that needs to be better represented in the research that we do. And that is how I would connect all of that together so that we can find out what those things are. Because I don't know the differences between a young person. I mean, I know what the difference is between a young person and an old person, but that sounded horrible. But I understand differences in age, but what I don't understand is how that impacts their mindset about the problem that we're trying to solve, right? So, you know, representing that that more diverse perspective in our research is probably the number one way to make those connections.
Could I ask, how have you found the experience of trying to, I'm guessing you've lived and worked agency life, is that correct?
Yeah.
How have you found the experience of trying to get your clients to do what you're describing?
It's hard. It takes a while for some clients to come on board to it, but we try to do it in as, you know, like as meaningful, but as least, with as little impact on timelines and everything, so that they have less to worry about. You know, a lot of our clients are very much into the, like, tell us we did it right, and they're doing that research at the end. That's what they think of as research. They don't think of it in the generative sense. And so some of them are into it, but it's definitely something that I would love more people to do, because that's where, like, you know, and I'll talk about this on Wednesday, but that's what inclusive design should be, is about, you know, incorporating people, you know, with diverse backgrounds into all phases, not just at the end, like, tell us we did it right. So, you know, it's hit or miss, and it takes a while for people to get to that point. Mixed results. I don't have any, like, I wish I had secret formulas, but I don't.
Toby, do we have time for one more? Okay. One more question. Fairly quick one. Anybody? There's Jason. Yeah, while Toby's making her way there, we were speaking a lot about people and teams and all that. I guess this is a little plug. I just released an episode today with Braden Kowitz of Google Ventures and the Sprint book, and he talks a lot about teams and the importance of building great teams and people. So I think the title is "People May Be the Most Important Design, Most Important Thing You Design," or something like that. Check it out.
Hi, this is Jason.
Hey, Jason.
Pimentel. I guess my question is for Mina. I guess, you know, I'm more of a hirer of designers more than I am of engineers or developers, and for me, the act of being able to describe the design is almost more important to me than the design work that the person has done itself. And I'm wondering, I was just thinking about your question about empathy, and I'm wondering, like, what would be the analog for you about evaluating a potential hire's work and their ability to talk about it?
What would be?
I guess in terms of, so if I'm thinking about how can a designer talk about their design solution and why they think it's successful, I guess I'm wondering, from your perspective, maybe you can't evaluate or teach empathy or feel like you can, but, like, what is the thing about a developer that you might be evaluating that's not the technical work? What is it about how they present themselves, they talk about it, or communicate about it that, like, really stands out to you?
Okay, there's, it's not really, it's sort of about empathy, but not really. But there is a thing that I have seen other people do, and I'm kind of trying to adopt myself, where particularly I want to see how they respond to, I'll just be very clear, if it is a white male that we're interviewing, I pay attention to how they respond to females or people of color in the room. I've been in many interviewing processes where they tend to ignore, if there's more than one person, they may focus their attention on the other white guy in the room or something like that. So I see how they pay attention to the women in the room and to the people of color in the room, and how they speak to them and the tone in that manner. And whether that gives me a decent indication of how they will react to their teammates in a certain sense. Also, I usually ask when I'm reviewing their work, I ask them about, I check to see how accessible their work is. I do like a quick little test of my own, and I ask them, have you considered how a person who XYZ would be able to use this? And even if they didn't consider it, the way that they respond to that question tells me a lot about how they respond to being challenged and how they respond to use cases that are not what they've considered before. So just being able to see how they respond to something that's outside of their realm will tell me a lot.
Awesome. Well, that's it. Thank you so much, everybody. Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks, Eric, for letting me do this. And Toby, Marcy, Mike, and company, all the hard work that they put into these events. Like, I've been at this for a while. This is still my favorite event. I'm not just saying that because I'm here on the stage. This is my favorite event. And I'm just glad you all are here after a long day. And thanks for being here. Subscribe to the show. Drop me a line. I'll do the random drawing later on the community. Thanks so much, everybody. Fight on, my friends.